Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Buttermilk Boulevard. I am your host, James, and we are here with the final, the last episode of the Big Four. Are you so excited? I am excited to be done with thrash metal. I am so tired of thrash metal. I spent all of 2020 listening to thrash metal, at least it feels like that. That and watching One Piece, but which is equally, if not just as irritating. In the last episode, we talked about Metallica. Well, last episode was the COVID one, but we had talked about Metallica previously, and today we are going to finish up this discography and finish up the final four as far as the thrash metal, American thrash metal specifically. Now, we'll just kind of jump right into it, honestly. No admin. If you enjoy the podcast, you're listening to Buttermilk Boulevard, consider subscribing. Tell your friends. Be like, hey, man, this Buttermilk Boulevard guy, you should check him out. It's completely free. You don't have to spend any money or anything. There's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You kind of know the deal. I guess it's follow on podcasts. But if you do want to leave a comment, go to those socials, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Send me a message, comment on the posts, whatever you'd like. If you're interested in me talking about a band, a different band, doing a different discography. I think in 2021, just to get a little bit of the podcast stuff out of the way here, in 2021, we're probably going to separate these discographies out a little bit more to give me a little bit more time to listen to them. Bands like Metallica that have 10 albums and probably more in the coming years. It's a little difficult to get through all that, especially like I had done previously, like Elton John, who had like 31 albums, and it's a little bit difficult to get those out and pump those out in a week or 2 weeks. So we'll probably spread them out a little bit more than we did, maybe do some album reviews here and there. But just giving you the little update that you all hoping for, I guess. But in the last Metallica episode, we did part one. We watched Metallica go from a barely known band to a very mainstream success, like celebrity level, famous, A-list type of shit, in just 9 years. Like that's right, from like 1982, they went from like a band barely even having a name and, you know, a single song written for Metal Massacre, to 9 years later, to 1991, being one of the top-selling artists of all time with the release of the Black Album. In part one, we covered the band's first five albums, often considered to be their best years by many fans, especially metalheads. Today, we'll probably cover we are covering the remaining five albums for the band up to the modern times. Now, if you haven't listened to part one, you might check that out before listening to this episode. If you're hoping for me to talk about, like, I don't know, the Black Album, for instance, it's not going to be on this one. This is really just all the kind of more recent records from 1996 on to 2016 and onward. But I guess this is probably a good time to tell everyone what isn't covered on this podcast. It's pretty simple, but sometimes people do get confused, especially with Metallica. We'll only be really considering the full studio releases for the discographies. There's plenty of EPs and other albums that came out post-Black Album, live albums, cover albums like with Garage Inc. There's that S&M stuff. They had one, and then in 2020 they released S&M 2. Those weird kind of collaboration albums with Lou Reed. We might mention them coming up here, but otherwise we won't really be talking about them in depth. I also found that in my research that Garage Inc. is sometimes considered a studio album, but sometimes considered a cover album, but I listened to the full thing and it's all covers. There's like not a single Metallica one. If there is, there's one, and I know a lot of people like the I Am Evil and some of those songs, but honestly, it's just not something we discuss here. So moving on, let's get this thing started. Our first album of the day is Load. It was released in 1996 by Elektra Records. Load is the sixth studio album by Metallica. Load is an album that draws a lot of debate for fans. Even on Wikipedia, this is probably the first album that is considered, quote, hard rock rather than metal when it comes to Metallica. The album was produced by James Hetfield, Lars Ulrich, and Bob Rock, released by Elektra Records. This album released to the number one spot and was generally well received as far as critic reception is concerned. The album went on to be certified platinum 5 times in the U.S., despite its multiple disputed whether or not it's good claims. I don't know what I'm saying. The album is a huge departure from their like thrash roots and more metal roots, and that really did throw off a lot of fans, actually losing fans to this day. A lot of forums and stuff like that, if you go to like comment section on Metallic posts, a lot of their fandom was just gone following the release of Load. Somewhat the Black Album as well, claiming it was some sort of like the band selling out, or but otherwise there's not really too much history on Load other than that. It was basically an album that Metallica decided, let's go the hard rock route, and then they released it, and depending on who you were, you either loved it or hated it. So yeah, but the critic reception, you know, was mostly pretty good, I would say. It was well received, and a lot of people didn't mind the change. Most people, especially non-fans of Metallica, were probably perfectly fine with it. It was more the hardcore fandoms, the Ride the Lightning, the And Justice for All, those kind of fans were a little bit taken aback by the change. And so I'll get kind of into my review here. This is a weird one. It is a weird album. Like, it's one of those albums that you think, is this the same band? You know, besides Hetfield, it's kind of hard to tell it's actually Metallica. So is this album good or is it? I would say, much like its name, it's probably more of a load of shit than anything else, to be a little bit blunt. But it's hard to say. I've listened to this album really one time outside of this listen through. This is an album that I listened to once and I was like, nah, and then just didn't go back to it. And it's basically, it's kind of like, it doesn't even feel like hard rock. It's like metal country. It's not really much of anything. This time I kind of approached it to be a little bit non-biased, because before, the first time I ever listened to this album, I approached it as everyone else does, as a Metallica fan, especially of the old stuff. Being a guitarist at the time, I was probably, you know, oh my God, hey, yeah, Ride the Lightning, you know, all that shit, Battery, that shit. That's where I was in my fandom. So when I listened to Load for the first time, it was like, was this intended to be a demo or, you know, this, what is this? But anyway, so I tried to approach it, my re-listen through, as non-biased as I could, being as objective as possible. And some of that Black Album kind of bled into this album, I'd say, but it's a little bit different enough that you can tell they really like force themselves to be different. There's really no other way to describe Load and the follow-up album, which we'll get to. It really sounds like Metallica. It's not even experimental per se, because it's hard rock. There's not really much experimentation. Probably that Lou Reed album that we'll talk about in a moment is a little bit more, I would say, experimental Metallica. Load is more Metallica intentionally being different. Some of the albums we talk about today, specifically one of them, is exactly that. Like, they're like, I don't know what inspired this kind of change of tone. I don't know that it necessarily works to that big of a degree. This album really does sound like a 90s kind of hard rock rather than like heavy metal. It kind of, sometimes it verges on that like nu metal side of things, and sometimes it's more of the grunge kind of sound. It's way closer to rock than actual metal, so I'm sure it throws off a lot of people that listen to it who are familiar with the band, especially like if you've only listened to their new stuff, or if you're only familiar with their old stuff and you go listen to Load, it's really going to throw you off. I don't think that it will make you not a fan of the old stuff, like some fans have quoted it as doing, but it's certainly a change and a big departure. But everything on this record is extremely simplified, kind of getting more into the breakdown of things. Like, the riffs are like really 1 to 4 notes. This is probably those memes you see where it's like, oh, it's 0, 3, 5 riffs, which is just the name of the fret on the top string, you know, whatever on the E string usually. Those 0-3-5 memes that you might see, that basically is this. There's a lot of like slow droning kind of riffs, power chord progressions that don't go anywhere. It's very simplistic, and that is also a big departure from Metallica, who is known to be very technical in their approach as far as music writing. The drums, I would say, are very much Black Album-like, meaning they're pretty simple as well. They are very slow, and by the time Lars actually hits the next beat in like the song, That House That Jack Built, you could really learn the entire last measure by the time that he hits the next note or it goes into the next measure. You know, it's that kind of snail's pace kind of thing. It's boring, but it's also simplistic. There's a lot of focus, I would say, on Hetfield's vocals, which is a very hard rock kind of thing. I don't think they did. It sounds hard rock. You know, they successfully pulled off hard rock, but I don't know that the album works to the degree that some hard rock albums would. There is a lot of focus on the vocals, like a hard rock album would. You know, some of those power chord progressions and stuff. If the band had done that from the start, I don't think that this album would be bad. But they try to make the vocals, like, I guess the voices be interesting by, like, layering them, and they're adding, like, these harmonic lines. There's these weird kind of reverb echo effects that they're adding occasionally. It's just a bit too weird to be interesting, if that makes any sense at all. It just comes off like, why'd you do that? Instead of, hey, I can dig this. You know, sometimes when bands do changes, you're like, you know what? You know what? Fuck it. I kind of like this. This album is more like, but why? It's like it's that Ryan Reynolds but why meme. You know, why did you choose to do this? Vocals as a whole are probably not the best we've heard from Hetfield overall. Songs like King Nothing is great and works for what we've heard, but the songs like Hero of the Day seem a little bit out of his range, or, you know, feel like maybe it's pushing his vocals too far. It could have been the place he was in at the time. Maybe his voice was changing, or maybe he was just too much alcohol and stuff. I know he struggled with addiction early on. I don't know at what point that was an issue. We'll kind of talk about the rehab stuff, but right now that's kind of it. But I don't know. The guitar tone, I would say, well, let's get back to the vocals, I should say. The lyricism in the album is kind of forgettable. The guitar tone is really a load of garbage. I absolutely hate the guitar tone. It's very muddled, and it's like a soupy mess. You know, it's not great. The bass is also has like very to little, no distinction. No play on actual the musicianship of any of these people. But as far as like tonality of pretty much everybody in this band, it struggles a bit. It's a good thing that these songs are slow, because God forbid they make it fast, you probably wouldn't hear a single lick the guitar does. Because of that kind of muddy, gross tonality, everything kind of just fuzzes together. So going back to kind of that song I mentioned, The House That Jack Built, that song is absolute trash, for lack of a better term. That talk box solo, it's too slow. It doesn't fit in the context of the song. Like, pick up the pace, you know. The song is long enough without the solo, so just take it out. Just cut it. It's not needed, especially in a modern time. But talk boxes are great, but I would say that they work better if used properly. And somebody like Kirk Hammett, who does not frequently use effects outside of the wah, which isn't a meme, he does favor the wah pedal in a lot of music. He probably should have just done the wah instead of the talk box. They're both kind of making a vocal-ish kind of sound. The wah-wah makes exactly what it's called, that kind of sound, that wah-wah-wah. And then same thing with the talk box. The talk box is basically like a robot voice. It's just modulating that effect. I would say that the talk box were pretty cool and hip in the 90s. Alice in Chains, for instance, used it really well. Peter Frampton pretty much invented the thing and made it popularized. Joe Walsh as well made it really sound interesting and fit. But Metallica, this is not the Rocky Mountain right way of using it. But The House That Jack Built is by far my least favorite Metallica song of all time. And to be fair, it's the album as a whole is not that bad in hindsight. There are some enjoyable moments, but this album has a lot of skippable songs, which I never really want to say in a Metallica album. So it kind of hurts a little bit my insides, but I think the opening track, Ain't My Bitch, that's a bit uncharacteristic for a band like Metallica. Ain't My Bitch, that sounds like probably like an AC/DC song, but it is a cool little ditty. I don't mind it. I think I enjoyed that song. Simple, but the riff and drum combo kind of works, and I found myself bobbing along to it. It was actually a good start to the record, because I was like, you know what, maybe this is going to be a good album. King Nothing, that's a pretty recognizable Metallica song as well. It's a good song, not a great song, but it does have a good melody, and it really does feel like it's set up by the bass guitar, which really works as far as a band that's mostly focused on rhythm. I think the guitar walks are really well done in that song. The vocal lines are pretty smooth. The drum is following the guitar rather than the vocals, which is interesting, and somehow it works in the context of King Nothing. Some of the other songs do it too, that it doesn't work. So we have examples of both, but, I do think the guitar tone is still shit, but the song is good. So like I said, I like the chorus again, great melody. It's probably King Nothing is probably the standout of this album. If anything, it's one of those songs that they'd probably play live, like in a mid set rather than like at the beginning and it'd be one of those like middle songs that everyone can go drink and get their drinks and food and shit. One of those like throw in song moments, like, hey, remember this one? You know, that type of thing, just to surprise people they're playing it. Look, long story short, I've been on this album a little bit too much. I can see why people might enjoy this album. I don't have any issues with people enjoying it. It's a hard rock album. I think it copies one too many ideas from probably modern rock bands at the time, like Alice in Chains specifically, who I've mentioned already. My biggest issue is everything is way, 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 way too slow. Songs like Poor Twisted Me could really benefit from the pace being up even one BPM, you know, just knock it up that one little notch, make it a little bit faster. And I feel like it would be better because it's at that point where it's drainingly slow. Like the pacing of the album makes the album difficult to get through. It's not even that the songs are long or anything. Again, it's like those doom metal bands, which, I mean, if anyone's familiar with that, where you're just waiting for them to hit that next chord. Like, oh, Sun O, are you gonna play that G, or are we just gonna sit here and listen to the last note you hit for 4 minutes? You know, I like that kind of shit, but I don't think Metallica is that type of music. So I don't know if they were playing with the timing intentionally or something, but like I said, I don't think the songs were interesting enough to really warrant too much experimentation. I guess to their credit, they had just had a, you know, huge top-selling best albums of all time mainstream success with Black Album. And then, so I guess that gives them the opportunity to fuck around a bit in the next album. Musicians, artists and music in general is the only genre or the only media type that can do that. Like, hey, the last one was successful, so let's fuck around and experiment with the next one. That is, music is the only thing, especially if you're a successful artist like Metallica. That is the only media type that somebody can do that. Because if you were to do that for a movie, like if you had a very successful sequel, let's say it's the second one in the series and it's amazing, everyone loves the hell out of it, it's the best thing anyone's ever seen, and then you try to experiment with a third, you're gonna fuck up everyone. Nobody's gonna want to see your fourth movie. Music does not have that issue, but for some reason, like, I don't know why, but yeah. So I guess Metallica experimented a little bit more, had a little bit more fun with this record. I can see it being fun to record and stuff. Like I said, it's just hard rock. It's they're just jamming, honestly. But it's a boring record. It's got one to two interesting singles on it, but really it's not worth drugging through the mud to listen to those two songs. Just buy those two songs on iTunes and probably call it a day. I'll give them some credit for being different, but honestly, Load, probably skip that one. Next up, we have a little bit shorter of an album review compared to the last album and other albums we've covered by Metallica. There's really not too much to say about this one. It really is like part two of Load. I think everybody already knows which one I'm talking about. But anyway, the seventh studio album by Metallica is called Reload. See, part two. So Reload was released via Elektra Records again, also Bob Rock, and came out 1 year after Load in 1997. Feels a little bit like one of those intermediary albums rather than a full release. Kind of like one of those albums artists put out with, you know, here's some of these unreleased songs you haven't heard. I believe Eminem did that in 2020 as like a modern example. Music to be Murdered By. He had released the studio album, and then later he came out with like it basically part two, which just had like six or seven songs or something that he didn't have on the original studio release. Honestly, that version is way better than the first one, which is weird. I think the production shot up better. But the album is actually produced by the same people, like I said, Bob Rock, Lars Hetfield. The history of this record is very minimal. Just like Load, there's essentially nothing to really be talked about. Essentially, Load was actually intended to be a double record, but due to some issues pumping out that many songs at the same time, they actually delayed part of the album to, I guess, be released later and to Reload. So this is, like I said, it's part two of Load. It's the B-side track on the same album. I'm surprised they haven't put them in a pack. Maybe they have, but like a pack of those albums together, because that's what it is, a bundle or something. But that's about it for the history, honestly. This is the album, the last album to feature the bassist, Jason Newsted. So I guess he avoided the travesty that is the next album. Spoilers. But you already know it. This is Metallica. You already know what their bad album is. So I will say that Reload is quite a bit better. Not like astronomically better. It's like a middle of the road kind of record, but it is much better than I think Load is. And much like the title suggests, it is very reminiscent of Load in pretty much every single way. That's why this review's a little bit shorter. My least favorite thing about Reload is probably the guitar tone, because again, the guitar is fine itself, but the tone is just not fine. It's the opposite of I'd swipe left, man. Is that the terms? I don't have Tinder. The tone sounds like really just hot, reloaded garbage. So just like the last one was garbage, this one's revamped garbage. So the guitar is... I think the guitar in this album just really sounds like how my guitar sounds to my neighbors. It's just, it's clear and great and quality to me, but to my neighbors, there's walls that separate us. There's foam to decrease the sound so they don't hear as much and all that stuff. So it gets muddled and sounds far away. Another example is like that club music when you're in the bathroom, you know, you're in the bathroom and like in a dance club or something like that. And it goes so, goosh, 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 you know it. But there's often like no music or it's different music in the bathroom. So you're hearing the club music like through the door. It's muffled. Why am I going into this? I guess the concerts have a similar thing too. So if you've been to a concert, you might know what I'm talking about in the bathroom, like if the bathrooms were placed behind the stage, like on those outdoor ones. Why am I describing this? But anyway, this is probably the worst guitar tone I've ever heard from Metallica. And as far as guitar in general, this is probably the worst. Even though I do enjoy Reload more than Load, I think that this album has worse guitar. But really, it's like listening to the same record. A lot of my review is going to be very similar. You know, I just think Reload has probably the better songs. There's probably one or two more singles. But my biggest issue with the album is how samey the songs feel. Like there's really no difference in the songs. And even though albums are, you know, tend to be cohesive or supposed to be cohesive, Tell that to Poppy, you know, but, even though they're supposed to be cohesive and stuff, I don't think that this album is too cohesive where it sounds like one big song. So I get why some of these were unreleased in the last album. Load and Reload are very much the same, in tonality, song arrangements, et cetera, et cetera. Side by side, you probably wouldn't be able to find a difference outside of the album cover. If I were to play, unless you're a hardcore fan of these albums, if I was to play Fuel versus King Nothing, I think most people wouldn't know which Load it was on. Like, guess which Reload. Was it Load or Reload? It's one of those, like, Jeopardy questions where you miss that. Rest in peace, Alex Trebek. But it's one of those type of questions that, you know, you hit the mark, but you just forgot the one word next to it. You know, what's those kind of things where you're just slightly off, so you're still wrong, you know? Anyway, speaking of Fuel, the first song on this record is Fuel, and it really is the highlight. And I think partially why Reload is better is just this song, because it is the highlight of both Load and Reload. Honestly, the pacing of Fuel should have been all of the songs on Load and Reload. It's the right speed. It's not so fast. It's not so slow. It's that pacing that the song kind of requires, which is what was the flaw in Load and somewhat Reload. Fuel is also a great tune. It's one that people get excited for. It's easy to play on guitar. You can put your guitar behind your head if you want. It's just one finger, you know, but the melody of the chorus is great. It's very sing-songy. It has great, good dynamic compared to, like, the main riff, which is a banger of a riff, by the way. Even though it's simple, it fucking works. The drums are great on the song. The lyrics are catchy, like I said. And then they follow up Fuel with Memory Remains, which is also a great tune. It's a memorable song as far as Metallica is concerned as well. Another one that'd probably be mid-set that you recognize, but you don't remember where you heard it. It's a simple song with admittedly an odd pacing. I'm actually not 100% sure that the drums are on time on that song, but it's still a great, you know, got some catchy lyrics. I think it would entice a lot of audience goers to sing along if they know the song well enough. I'm not 100% sold on the vocal chorus part, but the na-na-na-na-na part or whatever, it's like a gimmick for the audience rather than actually necessary for the song. I'll note that Unforgiven 2, I do not like. It is a popular one amongst fans, but I think it's popular because it's part of that trilogy of the Unforgiven. I don't like it. Two is my least favorite of the three. It's part of a trilogy. We haven't really discussed the third one too much yet, but it's a bit too close to the original Unforgiven for my liking. It sounds like a song that they made, like, and it's the same song, they just changed the lyrics kind of thing. I don't know. It's got a pretty cool drop at the chorus, but anyway, I like the belting vocals. I just think that overall, Reload has its moments. It's got a few extra little moments in there than Load did, but overall, Reload is just like listening to the same album. I've got the same grievances that I had with Load, and it was just carried over to Reload. They really didn't change much, and it wasn't even intentionally meant to be. Like I said, it was supposed to be a double album, so it was actually part of Load, technically, so I may not even cover it as a studio album, but, you know, whatever, it is considered one, so moving on. all right. Before we begin this next album, yes, I listened to Garage Inc., so no, I will not be covering it. It's technically a covers album. I'm not a big fan of it either, so I'm just leaving it off deal. Okay. One point I'll mention is that prior to the release of the next album, there was actually a well-known legal battle that I feel like I need to mention in the podcast with Napster. Metallica had discovered their music was being released and leaked prior to the releases onto a site called Napster. For those unfamiliar, it was a hosting site, which I guess kind of mimicked what torrent sites do now, or maybe it was like a Reddit. I never used it, even though I was around during this time, but basically someone could put up a song and people could just download it free. Or you could share it with friends. Maybe it was like the MySpace of music or something like that. I don't really know. The Battle Center specifically ran copyright infringement, but to be honest with the leaks of the songs, really it's just because like the artists aren't getting any money for those songs being essentially reproduced and stuff. There was a problem. I remember this back then in the early 2000s where there was a problem with people burning albums. Like there was a question of legality of being able to burn an album. Which burning an album, not like literally putting it on fire or anything, although some albums might deserve that. No, it's more like burning it to a disc. Like when you buy a CD, you can put it in your CD player back then, and then you could just take a blank CD and move the, just copy it over and over and over as many times as you want. So there were some legality issues with that. I don't remember if anything came of that because I don't think so, because most albums have, or most, not albums, like iTunes and stuff still have that option. But it was the same kind of idea, but Napster was an online site versus putting it on a CD and giving it to your friends with a Sharpie on it. You know the ones, come on, the wedding soundtracks. same kind of idea. It's just that, you know, people were able to leak things versus leak songs that were not available outside of albums, or leak songs that had not even been released yet. And I think Metallica was unfortunately one of the victims of this. So I won't get too much in depth in the Napster part of things because I don't really know too much about the legal court case and all those proceedings. But essentially the court actually ruled that Napster was to implement a filter program that would prevent downloads or leaks of certain artists, Metallica being one of them. I don't know who all was on that list, but you know, apparently if the artist requested it, Napster had to oblige. Honestly, the more you look into it, the more you're like, you know what? Maybe Napster was a fuck of a site. Actually, one of the creators, Sean Parker, which everyone should know, especially if you've seen that Facebook movie, Social Network. Sean Parker actually went on to be assisted in founding and creating Facebook, which has recently come over under attack for like data mining and stealing people's data or whatever. I think that's what data mining means. But anyway, it's just not a great reputation to have there. So anyway, moving on. The next studio album is Saint Anger. Yeah, the one we were all waiting for. The fan favorite, everybody's favorite album of all time. Released in 2003, Saint Anger is the unfortunate eighth studio album by Metallica. The album was again released by Elektra Records and produced by the band alongside Bob Rock. Not only did he help produce the album, but he actually stepped in as the bassist for the record because, again, Load and Reload were the final records for Jason Newsted. This album actually began being recorded in 2001, but Hetfield had entered rehab due to alcohol abuse and amongst other addictions. He was actually out by 2002, a year later, and they started resuming that production of the album. There's a whole movie you can actually watch about Saint Anger's recording process, so I won't go into it too much, but all I took from the movie was that these guys cannot fucking get along, at least during this recording process. That's really the takeaway, is that this long documentary shows that these dudes constantly bickered in the making of this album. Years and years together at this point, so they're probably family, so I suppose it kind of makes sense why they butt heads all the time. But at least at the time of Saint Anger, that's all they did was fight in that documentary. And I've seen it a few times actually in the past. I chose not to rewatch it for the sake of my sanity because it really is just like watching, I don't know, I think Jersey Shore is a good example where it's just people fighting constantly. That's it. And somehow people enjoy watching it. But I will say that instead of rewatching that, I did actually have to listen to Saint Anger. So I think I did my due diligence. But don't take that the wrong way. Despite the album's resulting muddiness, the movie actually isn't that bad. Some Kind of Monster. You might actually enjoy it. The album, though, Saint Anger was released in 2003. The album was pushed to an earlier release date due to fears that Napster would actually leak the album despite the court case. The court case, what's the word? Ruling. Saint Anger debuted at number one on the U.S. Billboard and in multiple countries. It won Metallica a Grammy Award for the title track, Saint Anger, for Best Metal Performance. Sounds great, doesn't it? Well, the critic reception, and more specifically, the fan reception, was not so stellar and has been a meme ever since it was released. So let's get into the review, to the point that most people are like, that sounds a little Saint Anger-ish, and then they hate it. Like, non-related metal bands. Like Cytotoxin has a little bit of that, unfortunately. They came out with an album that's got an eerily similar drum sound. Anyway, so we all know that Saint Anger is bad, right? Yeah. Okay, good. It's a rough listen. It's a very, very hard listen. I listened to it 3 times. You're fucking welcome. Instead of sitting around discussing what's bad about Saint Anger, let's actually start with what's good about Saint Anger. Not the snare. The drums are not bad, I would say. The tone is, but I swear if it wasn't for that distracting-ass snare sound, the drums would actually be pretty fucking good. Lars is really pulling himself forward here. He's really showing off a little bit more. He's actually on time, which is pretty cool compared to, like, Load and Reload songs. Frantic is probably the clear sound out as far as not just the album, but also the drumming bit. And Frantic is arguably a really good song. It's probably a good song in the sense of it being on, like, the B side of, like, a greatest hits album if Metallica were to put one out. It's got catchy moments and it's vaguely heavy, you know. I'll get to the snare in a moment, but hey, I suppose that, like, Frantic is my technically song recommendation from Saint Anger. But don't hate me if you hate that song. So I just wish the ending and the snare, I wish the ending of Frantic was like its own separate song. But that snare. Another good thing is the guitar riffs. Metallica is clearly trying to do something a little bit new by adding a heavier sound. If you watch the documentary, they kind of describe that they want it to be heavy. But I guess their idea of heavy is not the same as everyone else's. If you can hear the guitar over the drums, then you've got a good song. You know, anytime you can actually hear the guitar over whatever the fuck is happening in the mix with the drums, the guitar is pretty good. The intro to Saint Anger, for instance, that's a good one. They turned up the bass quite a bit. The guitar riffs are nice. And honestly, the bass is pretty good. I'm surprised by Bob Rock's performance in this. But Saint Anger is just a good example of, like, the bass quality too. Like, despite anyone's opinion as far as Saint Anger is concerned, the bass sounds fucking great. Like, they fucking focus on that. I guess it makes sense with Bob Rock being the bassist and also the producer. So he probably would have been like, yo, man, you want to turn that fucking bass up? But the lyrics are occasionally catchy as well, like Frantic. Nothing really interesting going on lyrically or vocally. It's just easy to kind of sing with. But okay, so that's the good stuff. So the snare is really bad. This is usually the snare sound is the blunt of many jokes, and I'm sure Lars is tired of hearing it and shit like that. But people oftentimes compare it to, like, trash can lids, dumpsters, and I think it might be a little worse than that description fits. I mean, I've heard car accidents with better snare sounds, so I don't think the snare sound is a testament to Lars's drumming capability, so I want to make that very clear. I don't think that the tonality of the drums themselves is a reflection of his ability to drum, because as I said, these songs are pretty fucking good as far as drums are considered, but the tonality of the drums is awful. I don't know whose decision that was. I'm not going to try and blame one person over the other, but, you know, if the shoe fits and you are the drummer, that you might be a little bit more responsible for the sounds that is being produced by your own kit, especially as far as the mix is concerned. I just don't want to make it sound like I'm shitting on Lars Ulrich specifically just because he's the drummer, but that sound, that tonality, it's rough. I know he has a lot to do with this record based on the documentary. I know he was one of the people that wanted it to be heavy. Their newer album that supposedly is in the works, but it's probably going to take 8 years if history shows itself. you know, it's... If history repeats itself, hopefully not, but Lars is advertising that the new album is supposed to be heavier, and that's how Saint Anger was also marketed, is that they were intending it to be the heaviest album they ever put out or some shit, and it's not heavy. They just tuned down their guitars and made their drums sound tonally odd and decided that that equals heaviness. It's like you're part of the big four. You created some of the heaviness that some artists still look at to this day. You were in, like, Slayer is an example of heavy and tuned to E flat or just an E standard. You know, it's heaviness does not come from the tonality of instruments. It comes from how things are played, the execution of certain instruments, using those weird kind of offshoot and flat notes and stuff like that. Anyway, I'm getting off track here. So I'm not here to shit on Lars. Don't make it that way. I know. But I think that this album is a reflection of like a difficult time for the band. They're arguing a lot. They're butting heads. They're showing up late to band practices and sessions. You know, James Hetfield is a struggling alcoholic at this point. He's out of rehab, but that doesn't mean that you're over your alcoholism. It doesn't disappear. There's no cure-all for addiction. You have to work on it basically your entire life. So, you know, this was probably still pretty fresh for him as well. And, you know, Kirk's not getting along with Lars and stuff. I mean, if you watch that movie, you'll kind of know. But the snare is clearly the worst part. I don't know that the snare sound is bad as far as like I've mentioned Cytotoxin. Cytotoxin album is good and it's done well. It's like an unlatched snare sound. It's basically the chain has been taken off of the snare and they're using it as a snare. But it sounds like a tom, like it has too much echo. There's nothing muffling that sound. But Cytotoxin, what they do well is that it's not too high in the production. That's where really this album falls apart, is that production and mixing of that drums. I don't know who decided, oh shit, we got to turn this snare sound up, dog. It sounds like shit. What are you doing? I don't like, did anyone re-listen to this? Because it doesn't matter what volume you listen to Saint Anger at or the songs in Saint Anger. The problem is the snare. The snare is bad. In any volume setting, it is too loud in that mix. Way too loud. So I guess the theory is in order to sound heavy, we need a dull snare sound and louder drums. So I guess that's what they were going for. And also, let's make the guitar tone crap while we're at it. So I've heard worse, though. Like, I can't complain too much. I think Saint Anger is a failed experiment for the band. But I have certainly heard far worse records than Saint Anger had to deliver. Just the problem with Saint Anger is the mixing and volume issues with the snare sound. Because the snare is really just too jangled. It's taking up too much space in the mix, and it's really hard to enjoy the songs. Even like Saint Anger, the song, and Frantic, and Some Kind of Monster to a degree. It's just what the problem is when you're listening to those songs, it's hard not to hyper-focus on the snare because it really is like in your fucking face. It's like when you're dreaming, having a nice dream, or a lucid dream, if you do that, and the alarm goes off, like your alarm goes off, but you're still asleep and you can hear it in your dream. It's like a fucking fire alarm. You know, it's that kind of thing where it's just in your face, so it's hard to ignore. Outside of the production and mixing problems and the snare, the song compositions are a little bit too janky and they're a little bit too random and fall flat to really get a feel for any kind of melody. There's random moments where they do a blast beat, kind of high BPM drum part, but the guitar stays kind of soft and mellow. Some Kind of Monster is actually a good example of that, where just like the BPMs and the pacing of the song doesn't really match each other for the different instruments. The instruments are not cohesive. The chemistry is off, and probably because of the chemistry between the actual members, the instruments actually kind of reflect that kind of thing. Some Kind of Monster is where the album really begins to fall apart for me. I think Frantic and Saint Anger are moderately good tunes. I think they're a bit rough, but they're salvageable songs. You might sit there and be like, you know what? Okay, I'll deal with that. And then you get kind of Some Kind of Monster, which is a fan favorite for a lot of people, admittedly. But Some Kind of Monster is like a combination of riff ideas, and like it just starts to be like that for the rest of the album, where it's just like a compilation of interesting riffs that they've thought of in the past, but let's not transition. You know, their transitions fall flat and they just kind of go into a new riff without any kind of buildup or any kind of flow. I mean, it's cohesive at least, but it's cohesive as far as like consistently rough, you know, consistently a little off. The album just kind of falls apart, and it's obviously the worst album as far as this. It's Saint Anger. If I were to rank these albums as far as all of the ones that I've listened to, Saint Anger would be probably my least favorite album I've had to listen to, and I listened to it 3 times, mind you. And I really, really tried. I tried to like it. I tried to be unbiased and be like, you know what, let's just get into this. But going into it, revisiting this album, I just cannot in good conscience recommend Saint Anger. I think it's probably the least favorite as far as these big four are concerned. And that sounds really fucking rough. But remember, this is Metallica, and they are consistently good. So it's weird that they put out an album that's not so good. Not weird. I mean, shit happens, but, you know, nonetheless, it's not a reflection of the band, but I know that this is a bad album, and that's about all I can say about it. So let's move on to better things. Quickly after the release of Saint Anger, there were actually rumors being spread of another Metallica album, which isn't unlike the band at this point. They're doing it now. So they literally release S&M 2, and then they're like, yeah, I guess we're playing music. So the internet's a buzz. You know, rumors of the 9th studio album began in 2004 and went all the way to the actual release of the next album. Much of the rumors for the next album centered around the idea that they were striving for a old or vintage sound, similar to kind of like their earlier records. It wasn't until 2007 that the band entered Sound City Studios, which is actually a documentary about that one by, Dave Grohl, Foo Fighters, maybe? I don't know, I haven't seen it. But they were all prepped and lubed for a new album when they entered the studio. Basically, by the time that this album came out, everybody was very invigorated, they were fresh, and they were ready for some good music. Metallica got with Warner Brothers Records and then hired famous, well-known producer Rick Rubin for the next album. There's a lot of extraneous information starting at Death Net Magnetic and kind of going onward. Extraneous is the sense of like, they made an appearance in like a talk show. They went on. Here's a single performance they did. Here's a video game they were in. All that stuff. Nothing really dramatic occurred, so I won't really be covering some of those extraneous stuff for my own sanity. And really, we only care about the fun drama shit to begin with. But Metallica at this point had reached a stardom / celebrity level where going out of their houses meant like a news article about them. So it makes sense that there's a lot of extraneous shit. I don't think too much has changed. In fact, I think it's probably gotten worse since Death Magnetic. Immediately following the release of Saint Anger, Metallica went on the hunt for a new bassist. The band auditioned musicians for 3 months until finally deciding on ex-Suicidal Tendencies and Aussie bassist Robert Trujillo, whose name I'm probably pronouncing wrong. Robert is the current bassist for the band, and to be honest, is not just a most phenomenal bassist, but at least has the appearance of chemistry with the other band members. They really just kind of goes right into the band like butter, I guess. I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to talk about a guy named Robert and Butter in the same sentence. But anyway, he just fits with the band well. He just seems to have a lot of chemistry with them, at least in the appearance of. Anyway, the band had a total of 25 songs that they wrote for the next album that they were considering. It was Rick Rubin that had made the decision that they weren't going to record a single note of the album until the band had finalized and polished every single song, which is very different from prior recording sessions where they do parts and figure out parts one at a time. Probably why Saint Anger actually ended up as bad as it was. But anyway, basically they had to polish their songs before putting it on there. So they actually narrowed the playing field a little bit, dropping the list from 25 songs to 14. To be honest, this is probably an excellent idea on Rick Rubin's part, just to maintain kind of some version of cohesive album quality. But anyway, the studio release ended up having 10 songs on it and a deluxe edition following, as well as an EP that actually has some of those unreleased songs, the 14 and stuff like that. There's actually like a demo deluxe version out there somewhere. I've only listened to the studio version and the EP, that Blackened EP or whatever it was called, the Death Magnetic EP. I have not heard the demo versions of it, because there's apparently a deluxe version out there with a second disc with a whole bunch of songs on it. I've never heard that. I don't even know where to find it. Spotify doesn't have it. iTunes doesn't have it. Where is it? Anyway, so finally, after about 5-ish years of rumors or so, the band would release their 9th studio album, Death Magnetic. In many aspects, Death Magnetic was considered a return to form, or if nothing else, a return to the genre that made Metallica famous. Metal! DM was, much like their other albums, at the number one spot almost immediately upon its release. So will the next album, spoilers. It's gone. DM has also gone on to be 2x platinum in the US and is often featured on top 10 lists for albums in 2008. The album received 5 Grammy nominations in 2009's Grammys, winning Best Metal Performance for My Apocalypse, which is a shame. It probably should have won the other 4. Rick Rubin also received a Grammy for this record for Producer of the Year. And an award that I'm sure he's got a lot, like 20 more of those on his bookshelf. He probably uses them as a paperweight at this point. But critic reception for the album was mostly positive. Really, until later, I really didn't see any bad things about this album. Once it was released, good things only. And I am very familiar with Death Magnetic. Really, unless you travel to those like metalhead forums on the internet and comment sections and stuff, the album was well received pretty much all around by fans and everything. Again, some metalheads like to pretend that they aren't listening to Metallica anymore, but then they sell millions of copies, so it's like, hey, you fucking lying. But this album personally to me means a lot in my path as far as a musician is concerned. Back when I was taking lessons, I had formed a little, small, going nowhere band with some fellow musicians from my lessons place or whatever. When this album was released, we were all pretty much obsessed with learning this album, like front to back. Just we needed to learn it. And it was Metallica, so of course we were going to. That happens a lot with like early musicians, where Metallica is really just the thing that inspires people to learn. It was really my first experience in a band of any kind at the time. And while it didn't go anywhere, I still kind of look at it pretty fondly. I mean, all of those people have moved on and stuff. I haven't really heard from any of them since. We were all children, essentially. Some of them have given up on music entirely or just disconnected. Some of them are doing fine. you know the huge. But anyway, as stated, I know this album quite a bit because I learned it like front to back. I didn't even have to listen to the album to really know what the song was. It's just in my head forever. It's been a while since I listened to it, actually, probably since it was released and I played it all those times, probably wore it out. So while remembering the album fondly and all this grandstanding, I didn't really enjoy the album the same degree that I did in my younger days, like learning it. I don't know what this was. I don't know if this was, again, like me over-listening to it and then returning to it, but just wanted to kind of put that up front on this review. Now, I still think that this album is easily recommended. And if anyone's like, hey, man, have you heard Death Magnetic? Is it good? I'd be like, fuck yeah, dude. Go check it out, bruh. Give me that weed. Anyway, it's got some great and cohesive ideas for Metallica. It is a good album, but I will admit that a lot of these songs go on a little bit longer than needed. Here goes my bad part stuff. But for instance, Broken, Beaten, Scarred, it was one of my favorites when I was younger, but I think now it ended up being my least favorite when on the re-listen, probably because it's like a minute longer than it really needs to be. It started to feel a little bit monotonous at a certain point. I'm surprised that Rick Rubin didn't actually call this out. Maybe it was a Metallica choice, maybe it was a Rick Rubin choice, but it really does, like, there's a section of the song at the end where you're like, does this need to be here? Like, they could have just cut this and it would be perfectly fine. But I don't know, it's one of those moments, like, Wonder Woman is like 2.5 hours long and probably a little bit longer than it should be. And there's a lot of segments that you're watching that you're like, you probably could have cut that, but, you know, fuck it. If it's going to streaming, might as well put the whole shit out there. a lot of these songs are within that kind of bracket where the pacing is just slightly too off. It seems like that's the thing that Metallica struggles with in some of these more modern albums, is just trying to get the pacing right. At times, the album drones on and I kind of lost focus on it. It didn't really keep my attention the same way it used to. I wondered if this is, again, a case of over-listening throughout my years. But I've also musically grown a lot since my youth, and I kind of understand music a little bit better, how things are arranged and put together, than I did back then. So I don't know if that's the case, or if it's a mix of everything, or my life experience, who the fuck knows. But there's a lot of times that the song, again, something like Broken, Beaten, Scarred, that I absolutely loved it, played the shit out of it. It was a huge hit for me. And now I'm just kind of like, it kind of misses the mark for me now. It doesn't vibe the same way that it used to. Like, oh shit, here comes the good part. But then they transition to a slower paced part. And it's like, wait, where's the punch? You know, there should be a punchline there. You're missing that, you know, it, rather than a punch in the gut or a kick to the face, it's like bumping your head on a cabinet or stubbing your toe, which some might argue is worse. But sure, it might not hit, but I don't know. I think the main thing is the pacing. That is the biggest gripe I have with this album. It's just a lot of songs that go on a little bit too long. It's just a little bit more tedious than I would say previous records were. I will say that a lot of the songs have pretty similar structures. The guitar riffs tend to be basic kind of power chord progressions or riffs written like in the A minor pentatonic. Seriously, if you want to learn any of the songs in Death Magnetic, whether you're an experienced guitarist or not, just go to the A chord and find the pentatonic, and really you'll just find, just occasionally you might have to jump to a fifth or a seventh fret, but it's the top E string and that's the riff. So going from like the mad dash that is Saint Anger to this kind of dramatic change in pace, it is a welcomed one, but honestly I don't know that Death Magnetic is as compelling as I remember it being. I don't give reviews, but I would say that this album would be probably a 7 or 8 out of 10 if I were to rank it or rate it. It's good, but not perfect. I enjoyed it, but it's not great. Wonder Woman 1984, 7 out of 10. Same thing. I enjoyed the heck out of it, and I have my reservations, even being a biased DC fan that I am, and I liked Batman versus Superman, but and I would still recommend it. Like, just, it's a good shut off your brain kind of simple superhero movie. But once you start thinking about it a little bit, it starts to fall apart. But you'll bob your head, you'll sing with the choruses, you'll get excited at the end of the day. But you'll get excited when the end of the day that never comes starts playing or something like that. But it's not really going to change your life necessarily. It's a good album, just not amazing, not a phenomenal record. You know, it's no Injustice for All or anything like that. I'm doing my best not to make this album sound bad here, so I'll kind of take a step back here. I know this is kind of the longer review of this podcast, but again, like Wonder Woman, people tend to focus on what they don't like. I don't know why it's so easy for humanity, especially post-2020, to talk about what's bad and a negative rather than to actually think about what's good. Like the invisible jet. That's awesome. How it happens, not so great. But that, the invisible jet, the Steve and Diana romance, how awesome was Kristen Wiig in that movie? I think she's fucking great, whether or not you like Cheetah or not. Who gives a shit? you know, it doesn't matter. And my main man, Pedro Pascal, bro, he is everywhere in 2020. That is amazing. Mandalorian is the greatest show of 2020, sometimes maybe of all time. But on the topic of Metallica and bands from the 80s, see what I did there. Death Magnetic has some awesome tunes, man. It is a good album, make no mistake. The riffs are fun, basic but fun, and you'll be mad because you didn't come up with them yourself. They're that kind of simple, kind of simplistic riff. Actually, somebody like Alice in Chains is very similar, who I've brought up in this podcast a few times, where it's just, how could I not come up with that? You know, it's so easy, but it's so fun and simple and catchy at the same time. It's a great Cyanide is an example of that. And Cyanide is by far my favorite record off of that. And although I have had many favorite records throughout the time, or favorite songs off this album throughout time, Cyanide is my favorite one currently. I used to love That Was Just Your Life, and then it kind of transitioned to The Day That Never Comes, and now it's definitely Cyanide. That of all of them, Cyanide is the best and has been the most consistent, fucking amazing song. That fucking riff, the drum and bass combo, amazing. Really juicy and like irritatingly simplistic for a band that is known for complexity and technicality. You know, that intro bass is so fucking good. As far as a bass tone goes, this is probably up there with one of the best bass tones ever. It's so good. It's really up there with like the Korn's bass tone or something like that. I don't really know how to just... I'm doing that off the top of my head, of course, so I don't know. But... maybe Geddy Lee from Rush, he's up there with that. I mean, it's that kind of thing. It may not have the same punch as like Korn's bass tone or something, but it's so well done and so perfectly balanced in that tune. Robert is really like a huge, huge addition to this band. He's so phenomenal. Listen to Cyanide and you'll kind of know what I mean. You'll be like, damn, that is some bass. But that's one thing that this album really improves upon, I would say, is its production. You can hear the money in this record. I know that's a weird thing to say, but you can really hear it. Everything has a perfect balance and level throughout. My chair is groaning and moaning right now. Drums have a tone to strive for. The volume is welcomed on the drums and the snare is good. Guitar is pumped up on the solos and stays in front for most of the songs. Lyrics sit on top of the vocals and back off during the instrumentation parts. The rhythm in the songs are the highlight. They're so good. James Hetfield being the number one rhythm guitarist in the entire fucking world in history that ever existed, he should get a lot of credit for this album, because I think Death Magnetic is a very heavy very heavy rhythm kind of album. It's very rhythm focused, and I feel like Hetfield's to blame for that. So I don't know who said, hey, let's make this next album rhythm focused, but God bless them. They realized what James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich's strengths were. So this is a great vocal album as well. I'll say this about this album and the next one, but the lyrical performance, the flow of the vocals, just the choice of pronunciations is very excellent. The phrasing of the vocals is very good. Hetfield is so relaxed, using a very natural kind of vocal. It feels like his vocals have healed, like in a way, from previous albums. I don't know how to describe it, but he's not stressing his chords at all. You as a listener feel relaxed when you hear it, and you also kind of want to sing along to it. It's easy to sing along to. And I don't know that this album is his peak performance, quote unquote. There's some people that say like And Justice for All, but that may be personal favorites. I personally think that this album, songs like The Unforgiven 3, for example, while it's not the aggressive style people know Hetfield for, I will say that I think, vocally speaking, this is the best Hetfield has sounded in Death Magnetic. I think like I said, he's just got everything down pitch perfect. Everything flows well. You know, like I said, the phrasing is good. The songs are catchy. The lyrics are good. And basically everything Hetfield is doing is just very well done in Death Magnetic. Anyway, kind of to sum up this review, which again has gone on a little bit longer than some of the other ones, it's not the best album they've done, but it is a great record nonetheless. There's a lot to enjoy on this record, and it is the highlight, I would say, of this podcast. And it's just a breeze to get through. I mean, there's a tune for everyone on this, and I cannot say that there's a bad song. I will say that the pacing's a little off. Broken, Beaten, Scarred may be the most tedious one, but again, not a bad song. 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, that's a good fucking record in my book. So check it out, Death Magnetic, great album. On to the final album, woohoo! After the successful release of Death Magnetic, the band's record deal with Warner Brothers was coming to an end. At this point, the band had gotten a huge following. Arguably, Metallica is one of the biggest bands of all time. I don't think anyone would argue that, actually. And is a household name to many people following the Black Album. In 2009, of January, it was announced that Metallica would be inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It says here, Rock and Roll Hall of Famous. So might as well be. Metallica accepted the award, asking Newsted to join in a performance at the induction ceremony. They also actually invited Ray Burden, Cliff Burden's father, to accept the honor on behalf of his son. Metallica also invited Dave Mustaine to take part, which Mustaine, of course, declined. Of course, that sounds so bad. But Mustaine declined, actually, specifically due to touring obligations outside of the United States. At this point, Mustaine and Metallica had long worked through their issues, which it's not really talked about too frequently in some of the later stuff, which is why I haven't brought it up too much. But a lot of their issues, I wouldn't say they're the best friends or anything. They're just kind of like acquaintance level or smaller, you know. It's like, we went through some shit, you know, I'll keep you at arm's length. But they're done with the whole fuck you and fuck you too game. But anyway, in 2010, a monumental event occurred in which all four bands of the Big Four got together and played a bill together. I would have killed to have been there, seriously. Like, it would have been so fucking cool to see all four of them together. But a bit of a time skip here. There's a lot of Metallica went on tour news, and it's really not that interesting. There's a lot of extraneous information, just like with Death Magnetic, that I'm not really going to cover too much. I will cover a few things like this, for instance. There were a few more Big Four meetups following the initial one, I suppose. And looking at videos of those events, it's really like those kind of fandom moments, especially if you're a fan of all four of them like I am. Ooh, my pop filter. But it's like one of those fandom moments, kind of like on Marvel or like the CW shows. Like the CW had the Justice League Flash on The Flash, the CW Flash. And it's one of those kind of moments where, like in Mandalorian, the end of season two, which I won't spoil because I know not everybody has Disney Plus. But the end of season two, we were like, oh, that's something that should have happened a long time ago, but hasn't happened yet. And you don't really think about it, but when it does happen, you're like, oh shit. Anyway, there was an album released in 2011 that I won't really go heavily into. I've kind of mentioned it through passing throughout this podcast. But the album was a collaboration with singer-songwriter Lou Reed, famous for that Walk on the Wild Side song in his whatever singing style that doesn't vibe with me. It kind of feels like talking rather than actual singing. But they put a collaboration album together, and it's called Lulu, and it's fucking weird. I'm not the biggest fan of that album, but I thought I'd at least mention it. I'm not going to do a full review, but I guess me saying it's weird is kind of my review. It actually would not be until 2011, 3 years after the release of Death Magnetic, that Metallica would begin circulating their kind of typical rumors, you know, like, will they, won't they type of shit, you know, just kiss the girl, for fuck's sake. At the time, the band was hinting the next album would be again with Rick Rubin. However, this did change later, specifically like a year later in 2012. After the contract with Warner Brothers had ended, Metallica had decided to form their own record label called Blackened Recordings. They actually acquired all of the rights to their own studio releases, and now they will be rich forever. So the label would actually partner with Rhino Entertainment, which is a subsidiary of Warner Bros., and Universal Music for the actual distribution rights. In 2013, the band released their 3D concert film and subsequent live album release, Through the Never, which I've never actually listened or watched, because I don't care about live albums. Through all of this, the band was continuing to claim and spread rumors that they were looking at their next record, which was, I'm sure, Metal Injection, Loudwire, Metal Sucks, you fucking name it. They were probably all like, they might be making an album, but what does Corey Taylor think? It wasn't until 2016 that the band officially re-entered the studio and began work on their next record, officially being announced at the 2016 Super Bowl 50 performance. Yeah, I just had to throw that in. This is a fucking throw-in sentence. But there's really little info as far as the recording process. It was more like they entered the studio, here's the album, but they hired the likes of Greg Fiddleman, probably saying that wrong, but it feels like I'm saying it right, who had worked with the band previously with Dead Magnetic, huh? It's a knockoff album, Death Magnetic, and he was the mixer slash engineer for Death Magnetic. There's a lot of weird, odd, shady information regarding his hiring. I don't want to say shady because there's nothing criminal happening, but there's a lot of weird quotes from like Kirk Hammond, stuff like that, about his production credit specifically. So I get the impression that he was kind of tacked on as the sounds great, guys, let's run it back, you know, that type of dude. And Metallica really was the producers. I get the impression that it took a lot of notes from what Rick Rubin did, and there was some mention that he may or may not have received credit on this album. I didn't see anything, but his name came up a few times. It's neither here nor there. Craig Fiddleman has the production credits. I'm sure he assisted with production. So after years of fake rumors about them actually releasing a studio record, the 10th studio album finally released in 2016 called Hardwired to Self-Destruct. And it feels like the most appropriate song for 2020 or album. Hardwired was once again in the number one spot, their sixth album consecutively to do so, reaching the top charts in 57 countries. Holy fuck. It was on multiple top 10 lists of 2016 and probably overall, and was nominated for a Grammy for the best hard rock album. I'm not hard rock album, just rock album. The album has since gone platinum once in the U.S., but I'd say since it is a little bit more recent, probably give it a couple of years, it'll be at least four. So finally, the critic reception was mixed, generally positive, but the lowest review I saw was a 2 out of 5 from the Chicago Tribune. I'm not sure why, but they rated it 2. I think that's a little bit unfair as far as the album's concerned, but we'll get into that. Some of the higher reviews landed 4 out of 5, 6 out of 10, probably closer to what my review would be. But, you know, anyway, moving on. I've come to realize that my taste is a lot different, especially when it comes to critics. Some people think things are like masterpieces that I just think are okay. And then some people like, you know, I love like movies that are wildly panned, like everyone hates the fuck out of it, worst shit ever came out, and I'm like, you know what, it's okay. You know, I'm one of those guys. Like, mainly that comes with the DC stuff, because I am a DC fan, so really seeing the heroes that I grew up with, I've read media like the comics and all that stuff, seeing that stuff on TV, just, you know, it really just tickles that kind of inner childhood in me. So I'm going to like them. And you know what? Fuck it. Why not? I'm going to continue to like them. But anyway, you do you, boo-boo. It's one of those things. You know, if you like it, you like it. You don't, you don't. I don't know why everybody needs to make a big fuss over somebody having an opinion, which actually seems like a relevant statement lately in the U.S. Anyway, this is a long, drawn-out way of, and the wind-up and the pitch, here comes the oh shit, it's a curveball moment, that's saying that Hardwired to Self-Destruct is okay. It's just okay. It's not bad. I don't think it's great. I think it's just okay. It's a middle-of-the-road record. I don't think it, you know, if I were to rank these, it would probably be, if I were to do, there's only 10 albums, so, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, something like that. I'm not actually sitting here ranking them, but I think maybe my mood affected my taste of this album this year, because when this album came out, I was all fucking for it. It was on repeat constantly. Maybe I should, you know, revisit past episodes to see if albums I like, past episodes of this podcast to see if like albums that I loved have changed or not. Maybe it's a 2020 mentality kind of dripping over into 2021. But when it was released, Hardwired was the shit. Like I was so hyped about it, running on treadmills, listening to the album and stuff. And it was great. I was so hyped up about it. And then now it's just like, yeah, I guess it exists. And I think maybe some of that could have been like the hype around Metallica actually releasing a record. You know, that happens to you, you know, like you have all this hope, this momentum, this excitement that just kind of builds, like that thing that you're so excited for. Metallica was one of those things, like they're releasing a new record, they're releasing new, if it's anything like Death Magnetic, it's bound to be good. And then it comes out and you're just hyped about it, like regardless of how it actually is. You just get up, you just immediately love it before it even hits your ears, you know, like you're pumped up and you're just like, fuck yeah, this is a good song, move on. You know, I gotta wonder if that was that, you know, that kind of hype mentality. And now it's just kind of all the hype have been down and I can actually sit back and actually analyze what's going on. Enough bullshit. Hardball. Bleh, 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 bleh. Hardball. Hardwired to Self-Destruct certainly has its moments. It's got great riffs and it's closer in sound to probably Death Magnetic than say Saint Anger. It's nothing like their older stuff. There's a lot of comparisons drawn to it, but honestly, they salted it a little bit with some thrash. Maybe there's a little bit of tribute or they pay homage to some of the past stuff, but I don't think that this resembles their old shit whatsoever. The album suffers a little bit from kind of that same monotonous repetitiveness that Death Magnetic suffers from. It even copies the longer than needed song structures that I mentioned. Wonder Woman could have been at least a nice 90 minutes, but you know, fuck it. I'm a nerd. Give me all of the things. So Hardwired stands probably alone in this discography. I cannot really draw many comparisons. I think it's the freshest album on here, not just as far as release date, but actually like it's fresh as in it feels like a new Metallica in a lot of ways. In fact, there are moments in this record I think, wait a minute, are they like tributing Slayer? Are they tributing Anthrax? It feels like a coalescing puddle of all of these experiences that we've talked about, which is a great fucking way to end this podcast, by the way. But it really does, like it just feels like a record that happened smoothly, even though there was a lot, it took a while to make and there's a lot of rumors spreading around it. But I bet the recording process was smooth as shit. It sounds like it was fun, not a fight. I mean, the album feels that way. I don't know that it was, but Kirk, like almost like Kirk Hammett comes up with a riff and then, you know, Lars is like, fuck yeah. And then starts jamming with the drums and then everybody just joins in. It feels like that record, like you're listening. It feels like you're listening to the band enjoying themselves. You know, let's roll with it. Why not? You know, it's our fucking record label. Do what we want now. It just gives the vibes of enjoyment after years of like hard thrash metal and hard music and all the bullshit and Saint Anger and all that stuff. Now, I will say it's no Summer Breeze to get through. I don't think that this record is that easy to listen to. Overall, I think that is mainly due to the song lengths. The fact that the album was split into two discs already is probably not a great sign, and there's not a lot of songs on there. It's two discs, as in, like, it's two discs because the songs are, like, you know, I don't know, 8 minutes long and shit. I don't have it in front of me, but it's got those kind of monotonous song structures that Death Magnetic had, where it's just, it sometimes becomes a beating to get through it if you're trying to analyze it. Now, if you're just sitting back and enjoying it, it's probably easy, but I don't know. I just think specifically, I think the album takes a bit of a hit in like the middle of the runtime. Like when you go from some critics said this too, where like the, and I'm not copying what they're saying, but like disc one sounds great. And then disc two or the B-side doesn't have the same kind of panaz. I don't disagree with that. I think it's more like the middle section, like the mid set, like the stuff, like you get the singles real fast, they punch you in the face, they get Hardwired, Atlas Rive, Moth to the Flame, but then there's like after that track five with like Dream No More, it's kind of like, And okay, this is a song. Okay, this is a song. Yeah, this is a song. You know, it's not like they're not standing out as amazing. They're not bad either. They're relatively enjoyable. They're just kind of like, it exists. I think in a vacuum, all the songs are pretty good. Like if they came on your shuffle, any one of these songs would be, you wouldn't skip it. It would be fun to listen to. But I think as a whole, like the slower pacing makes the entire album, like listening to the entire thing consecutively, a little bit more difficult because of that pacing again. And that's a thing that keeps coming up this episode specifically, is that the pacing seems to be the problem, or the length of songs, which I don't normally complain about. I listen to bands that have like Meshuggah, that frequently has 8 to 13 minute tracks, you know, or Tool or things like that. But there's a way to do songs that are long like that and not make them sound tedious or monotonous. Like Reptile, actually, by Periphery. Some people might argue that is too long, but I don't find that song, like, it's almost 20 minutes long. It does not feel 20 minutes long. Or have you ever watched a YouTube video that's like 50 minutes and you don't even realize you watch 50 minutes? Like, it just goes by in a flash, like you barely watched it. I don't think that this album did that correctly. Like I said, the pacing is just a little bit off-putting. Eventually you'll just start to feel like, maybe I stop and listen to something else, come back to it. And I did frequently. I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop here. I'll come back to this song and re-listen to this part and all that stuff. So I don't know. It seems to be lacking that flavor to keep your interest long-term. What am I talking about? When I think about my previous obsession that I had with this album, I'm kind of reminded that, one, yes, I was mentally willing to accept any flaws that the album might have had when it was released, but two, I often gravitated and repeated specific songs. Again, like, I would listen to it specifically when I was on the treadmill. I used to work out more and stuff like that, and then 2020 came along, and it's like, yo, fuck your workout plan, but fuck your workout plan, here's 20 pounds. So, but nothing really, like, I would listen to those, like, couple of tracks I've already mentioned, Hardwired, Moth to a Flame, Atlas Rise. Those would be my treadmill songs, and they were good treadmill songs because they were kind of lengthy. I could be like, okay, that's 15 minutes, time to stop, move on to the weight section or something. Now, is this album worth a recommendation? I think it's worth a recommendation in the same way that Death Magnetic is. It's a successful album with a lot of cool songs, a lot of good moments. It's a good album. Make no mistake, Hardwired to Self-Destruct is a good album. But it's another 7 out of 10 for me, like a 6, 7, 8 out of 10. Each song has something for everybody, even if you're not a Metallica fan. I think this one specifically, Hardwired, is probably more catered to anybody, rather than Death Magnetic seem to be a little bit more catered to metal fans. That may be a matter of opinion, but that's what all this podcast is in the first place. I think it could intrigue you if you're a casual listener, but I think if somebody's like, hey, what should I listen to off Hardwired, you'd be better off recommending specific songs rather than the entire album. Because I'd be like, you know what? Hardwired, if you're going to listen to that, Moth to the Flame's the one you need to listen to, or you need to listen to like Atlas Rise, like I said. But overall, I just think it feels a little long. It just feels a little slow compared to some of the other records, or tedious, not slow. It's not slow. The album's not slow, but it's tedious. It's a little bit monotonous. You get tired after a while of listening to it. And part of me, if you can't tell, is tired of listening to thrash metal. So it is recommendable. But anyway, who knows? I think that's it, though. This is the final of the big four. If you've stuck through these episodes, man, like I said, I'm fucking tired of thrash. So thank you so much if you've listened to all of these big four ones. I know there was a lot. Really, I wasn't going to do it prior to 2020. 2020 is why I did it, because I had time to just do it. And it's been a hell of a fucking journey for myself. Listening to all these albums, there's a lot of things that have been enlightening to me. Bands like Anthrax, I had little to no experience, and now I listen to them like all the time. Like, even on my podcast, I probably gave Anthrax more shit than I remember, but some of those songs are just good to listen to casually, just you know what? I guess I'll listen to Among the Living now. You know, I just sometimes it vibes. And then same thing with like Megadeth and Slayer and stuff. Slayer has become my go-to. I'm pissed off. Like if I get a phone call, again, work in insurance, so it happens a lot. But as far as like Slayer has become my go-to, I'm pissed off, I need to take 5 minutes to step away from my desk and come back. Slayer is my go-to now. Like if I'm pissed off and I need to chill, I listen to hard music. It's probably the opposite. Some people listen to rain sounds. I listen to Raining Blood. So, you know, it's that kind of shit. But same thing, like Metallica. It was actually fun to revisit Metallica. I will say of all of them, this is the band I know the most. So it is fun to kind of re-listen to a lot of this stuff, especially the older stuff. Their old stuff is just next level phenomenal. There's really, seriously, nobody like Metallica when it comes to artists. They are consistently good, with the exception of Saint Anger, which is really just the only stain on their history as far as I'm concerned. But they're just so good. I mean, if I was going to... I might do a ranking. I haven't decided yet. The only issue with a ranking is I feel like I'd have to listen to some of these albums again, which I don't know that I necessarily, I need to take a break from some thrash. I need to move on to some pop music or some shit. I don't know. But, it's like, I'm not gonna, I thought about doing Testament and things like that and probably feeding y'all too much behind the scenes info than you need, but I thought about doing like Testament because they're technically the fifth member of the Big Four. I thought about doing like Exodus and stuff like that. But I just need a break from thrash, to be honest. And I don't think any metalhead's going to listen to this and be like, how dare you? I think most of them are going to be like, you know what? I fucking get it, dude. Move on to some deathcore or some shit. You know, why not? Because sometimes that stuff is just monotonous. And a lot of bands tend to gravitate to these four that we've already talked about, and they tend to sound a little samey after a while when it comes to thrash. Luckily, these four bands are different enough in their album discographies that it doesn't get stale. Like I think Slayer, if any of them, Slayer is the most consistent throughout their entire discography as far as sound. They're the most consistent thrash band of all the Big Four. Megadeth has a little bit of it, but they do get off there a little here and there. Anthrax is the only one that I'm kind of like, that do a little bit too much experimentation. That's not a bad thing, but that's a little bit too much experimentation to really consider them like a consistent thrash band. I know they're the ones that invented the terminology, but it's just weird to me that Anthrax would be considered thrash. When really they're just kind of heavy metal. That's no disdain on their part if they consider themselves thrash. Who am I to say otherwise? But some of those early stuff, Fistful of Metal, Among the Living, Spreading the Disease, some of those were very thrash-centric, but then you have the grunge records too, like in the 90s. And those are not thrash whatsoever. And they're still just as good, like Sound of White Noise, pretty good. We've All Come For You. I don't know that I care for that one, but Stomp 442, I'd Rather Die. So, you know, those kind of things. But I'm getting a little bit all over the place, kind of ranting now. But the long short of it is there's a reason these four bands are considered the Big Four. They had their ups, and some records to this day are some of the more hype-selling records and talked-about albums of all time. They had their lows, and some of those are just as talked about as their high sellers. And some are, like, impossible to get through, like Diabolicus and Musica or Saint Anger. Some of those are difficult. And then you have some that are Master of Puppets, Spreading the Disease, Slayer's Raining Blood, those types of records, or... Slayer's Rust in Peace, or Megadeth's Rust in Peace record. I'm mistalking here. I mean, it's just a fucking journey, and some of those have been added permanently to my playlist, specifically some of the Megadeth ones, because they're probably the one I didn't own any of their music, but Anthrax is the one I've listened to the least, but Megadeth is one that I'm like, why don't I own this? You know? And a lot of these albums, a lot of these big four mean a lot to specifically guitarists and early learning musicians. Because they are so accessible and their music's so catchy and so fun. And it really is like, you know, trying to learn the Master of Puppets record is an exercise in itself. And once you do it, it is a very uplifting experience for somebody, like beating the boss in Dark Souls. It's that kind of, you feel so satisfied and glad that you're able to get the opportunity, not just to learn it, but to listen to it, enjoy it. And you're just learning these songs on the guitar. It's like, I can't believe I can do this now. Actually, Slayer, I mentioned this in the discography. Now I've done it and it's actually done really a lot of numbers on me, but like Slayer specifically, a lot of their songs have like this tremolo picking that is phenomenally fast. Like literally Rain and Blood has that tremolo picking part that's right after the main riff. And I went out of my way to figure out the BPM, to go with a metronome, to try and pick up the speed to that song. Like, it encouraged me to pick up my guitar and try to learn it. And that is what these bands are meant to be. That is why they're the big four, because they inspire people to be musicians themselves. They make people feel better when they've had a bad day. They make consistently good records. Metallica's listened to like over a billion times in 2020. That's no accident. People didn't listen to Metallica in 2020 just because they're fans. I mean, they have over a billion fans. I definitely contributed to that number, but it's because it's uplifting music. It's fun to listen to. It's good songs. It makes you vent kind of your angry side and your stressful side while also, you know, increasing the side of you that enjoys that kind of thing. And I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know why I'm getting philosophical on fucking thrash metal bands, but it, you know, these bands mean a lot to a lot of people. So I want to make sure I at least give them the credit that they deserve, that they have certainly gotten over the last, you know, 20, 40 years of their lives, but lifespans, whatever. But anyway, if this is your first episode of the Big Four, maybe consider listening to my reviews of Slayer, Anthrax, Megadeth. That Slayer discography is one of my most popular tracks on my podcast. You might check that out. Did really well for me, and this it's really exposed me to a lot of new listeners like yourselves. I mean, I'm happy to have done it. I'm glad I did. We're certainly going to be talking about these bands, you know, for the rest of time, and I'm sure I'll bring them up again in future episodes. But that being said, thanks again for listening. I'm James with Buttermilk Boulevard. If you enjoyed the podcast, consider following, subscribing, or whatever the fuck it is on your platform. if you you might consider recommending this to a friend if you enjoyed it enough. Just try to build up this podcast base if I can. So I'm going to advertise as much as possible. Maybe consider Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, if you have those methods of whatever social medias. Maybe consider sending me a message. Let me know what bands you'd like me to cover. Do you want me to do a Testament episode or another thrash metal episode? Who do you recommend as far as your favorite thrash band? Are you a Gravedigger fan or a Creeping Death? You know, are those, let me know. What's your favorite Big Fours? What do they mean to you? Let me know. I'd love to talk with somebody about it. So I like music and I like to talk about music, which is why I have a podcast. Neither here nor there. Anyway, thanks for listening, guys. Anyway, that's it. I've talked enough. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me on this journey. I'll see you next time when we do the 2020 Best Of episode. Until then, you keep rocking on, people. I'm James with Buttermilk Boulevard. Peace out.